Hi, this is Julie Budd, and I have a brand new CD out. Julie Budd, Remembering Mr. Sinatra. If you love Sinatra, I hope you'll love this CD. And I'm talking with Rabbi Saul Solomon on Dave's Gone By, UNC Radio.
Oh, shalom, shalom, my friends. Happy almost New Year to you. This is Rabbi Saul Solomon, the founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And I am delighted and excited to be talking to yet another entertainer, an actress, a talent, a woman who has a new CD out. You can also go see her at the Metropolitan Room. You know, sometimes we like to nip things in the bud. Today we're going to bud things in the nip. And that doesn't even mean anything, but it means something to me because I'm talking with Julie Budd on the telephone, and we welcome her to the neighborhood. Shalom, Julie!
Shalom, Rabbi. How are you?
I'm all right. You know, I've got the usual complaints about my hip and a toothache. How about you? How are you doing?
All is good. All is good.
All is good. Do you speak Hebrew or Yiddish?
A little bit of Yiddish. You know, I grew up with my grandparents. We used to hear it around the house. And, you know, it was kind of fun to grow up with grandparents. I was spoiled all the time.
Of course. Okay. Now, I think you said off the air that you have rabbis in your family?
Yeah.
Any big major hoo-ha rabbis or what?
Yeah, the hoo-ha rabbis in the Satmar community.
Really? Oh, you're from the Satmars.
Part of my family is Satmar. When we were kids, we were raised modern Orthodox. And then when my grandparents went back to their house, we were a little bit even more relaxed than that. But I was raised modern Orthodox because my grandparents lived in the house, and my grandpa and my grandma were strictly kosher and Orthodox. So
whoa.
After I went to school, I went to Hebrew school every day.
Good for you. Do you have any favorite Hebrew words?
Hebrew words?
Yeah, you know, pick one.
Pick one?
Yeah.
Well, shalom is the most important one.
That's a nice one. That's a good one.
That's a good one. And children should always have their manners and say todah. They should always know to say thank you.
That's right.
Those are the important words, because you want everybody to know you're a mensch.
Oh, very. Wait, what's the female word for mensch? Or is it still mensch?
It's mensch. Isn't it mensch? Just plain mensch. And if it's a whole bunch of people, it's mention, right?
Mention, right. But there's no womanly mensch. There's no menschette.
Oh, no, it's not like that, no. No.
All right, mensch. I usually hearing about a nice Jewish boy man type. Mensch usually comes with a penis, so that's why I'm a little surprised.
No, just a girl could be a mensch, a guy could be a mensch.
Or a menschita.
But it's best to be a ganzer mensch.
Oh, a ganzer mensch, who says, by the way, todah rabah. That's the bigger one than the todah. You add the rabbah in there. It's like, ooh, thank you very much.
That's like super duper.
Yes, yes it is. And you are, by the way, having a super duper career right now. You just released this week your brand new CD. It's called Mr. Sinatra. Tell us, what could that possibly be about?
Well, actually, the CD is called Julie Budd Remembering Mr. Sinatra.
Ah, okay.
And the reason why I call it Remembering Mr. Sinatra is because, you know, I've been singing since I'm 12 years old, and when I was 16 years old, Mr. Sinatra invited me to Las Vegas to appear with him at Caesar's Palace.
Whoa.
And this recording is a little bit of a tribute and Valentine to all that wonderful music that was performed when we did those concerts at Caesar's Palace. And, you know, it's so funny, when I sing very, very often with symphonies and in performing arts centers around the country and around the world. And when I do these songs, I close my eyes, and it's like I'm back there again. It's those wonderful evenings on stage with Mr. Sinatra. It's funny, because when I got the show, when I was told that I was going to be appearing with him, I had heard all kinds of conflicting reports about what this man was like, yeah, and what I should be careful of, and, you know, don't say this and don't do that. And, you know. And when I got there, it was anything but that. He was very warm. He was very craft-oriented. He was very nurturing. He couldn't have been more respectful to my dad. Isn't it funny how you really don't know people unless you experience them yourself?
Well, this is true. I mean, if I were your parents and you were a 16-year-old girl going to visit Frank Sinatra, I would have all sorts of worries and questions. I probably would have said, you know what? Stay away from that guy. You should stick with comedians. Go meet Bill Cosby instead.
Right, exactly. Which could actually be more dangerous. But I have to tell you, honestly, truly, it really taught me a lot about you have to experience people for yourself. You cannot go with what people say. You really need to experience people yourself.
Well, was that still one of the defining moments of your life, the first concert that you did when you were there and it was on the bill with Frank?
Well, it was certainly a very pivotal moment in my career, and it was certainly a very special and extraordinary time because, you know, there are a lot of people paying tribute to Mr. Sinatra, but interestingly enough, none of them knew him. I think I can say, you know, with modesty, but truth, that is the difference between my project and theirs, is the fact that I knew him. And so, therefore, there's a lot of heart that goes into this because there's a lot of personal feelings that went along with choosing this music as well.
Well, what would be an example? What song would mean something very special, particularly to you, because you knew personally Frank Sinatra back when you were 16, 17 years old?
Well, for instance, the song All the Way. I'm sure you know the song.
All the Way. Yes, yes.
Right, and I'm sure your listeners know the song as well. And it goes back to when he did the movie about Joey Lewis's life. And the song All the Way was a very important song to him. It was a huge, huge hit early on in his career. But for me, it was a very special song because what Mr. Sinatra used to do is I used to go on and do my portion of the show. And he was very generous with time. He let me do 35, 40 minutes, which was enormous. And I went on and I did all these wonderful standards and talked to the audience about how I loved being there. And I was, yes, 16 years old. Well, not quite barely 16. We worked together in April. My birthday's in May, so I wasn't quite.
My God, you were 15. Wow.
I was just turning 16. And then he used to set up a little table and chair on the wings. And every night I used to watch his show. I used to grab a little dinner, and I used to sit in the wings and watch his show. He used to turn, and he used to look at me in the wings every now and then and, like, shoot me a little wink and a little thumbs up, you know. Like, he was wonderful to me, you know. And I remember All the Way, he was most still on that number. He was very still on it. And I enjoyed the fact that I was very close to him when he was working. I mean, I was maybe 8 or 10 feet from him because I was right off the left wing, you know.
Yeah.
And I would just sit there and I would watch him do his work and I would watch how he would pronounce and I would watch how he would become the actor along with the singer. And, you know, it was a great lesson for a 16-year-old. It was, and listen, I had the best seat in the house too, you know. But it was a sweet memory. And when I decided to record it, it was interesting how I would record it and perform it and then find myself there mentally again. It was a very, very warm memory for me. I was glad that I recorded it. It was really the right song for me.
Now, did you run into him? It's amazing you still call him Mr. Sinatra. It's like when we meet our fourth grade teacher in a supermarket and you still call him Mr. and Mrs. something, even though, you know.
It's interesting you should say that. Someone else mentioned that to me today, and you know what it is too, you know, he was over 40 years older than me. So when you're barely 16 and somebody is over 40 years older than you, I was raised in a time with the kind of parents and family when somebody was your elder, unless told otherwise, you called them Mr. or Miss or Mrs. It was the way you addressed an older person, and that was the way I was raised. He was much older than me. He was older than my father. Hmm. And, you know, he was somewhere between my father's age and my grandfather's age. So therefore, I addressed him as Mr.
And still do.
And yes, and even today, when I meet somebody's parents or their grandparents or their aunts and uncles, I don't know about you, but, I mean, I still address them as Mr. or Mrs., you know, I was just raised a certain way. It's just the way I am, and I think it's people are the elder people are due their respect. You know what I mean?
Oh, like, although usually I just say, "Hey, you."
Yeah. And if, I didn't want to do that with Mr. Sinatra because I didn't want him to kick me off the show.
That's one person you don't push aside while getting to the canned peas. You just let him walk at his pace.
Nice to me, though. I really have to tell you. I mean, there are people that just don't believe me in the business. Oh, I heard he's this. Oh, I worked with him and he was that. Oh, he was rough. Oh, he was, you know, he was all about himself. Oh, you want to know something? I learned something about Mr. Sinatra, and one of the things I learned about him was that when you did your job and you came up there and you showed up like a pro and you weren't fooling around, he showed you the right respect, and you couldn't ask for anything more, really.
But did your paths cross older, later on?
I'll tell you what happened, and it was sort of interesting. Toward the end of the engagement, I remember saying to my conductor, Herb Bernstein, who, by the way, is still my conductor. He's been with me since I'm 12 years old.
And from the name, I gather he is a Jew, too.
Yes.
Yes!
Tribe. He's a Ganser Yid.
Of course.
And I said to Herbie, I said, you know, Mr. Sinatra looks like he's ready to leave the engagement. Like, you know, he's had enough. He's tired. And it's interesting because the next year, you know, Mr. Sinatra had two retirements. The next year he entered his first retirement.
Ah.
And isn't it funny how as a kid I sort of picked up the vibe that he was sort of ready to not do this anymore. That he became very tired at the end of the engagement. And, you know, it all became too much. I really think he was ready to get off his voice, to stop. He had had enough. And interestingly enough, the next year he entered his first retirement.
And but was that the last time you... When was that you actually met him?
Well, I'll tell you what happened.
Yeah.
The last time I saw him, and then about a year and a half later, I was asked to appear in New York City for my 18th birthday at the Copacabana. And I was asked to headline there on my birthday. And when I was at rehearsal, I received an envelope. Now, Mr. Sinatra lived in Palm Springs. In fact, he used to go home every night on his own private plane.
Huh.
Never stayed in the hotel. It just wasn't private enough for him. People used to drive him crazy, Rabbi. You have no idea how people used to drive
him. Well, people drive me crazy every day.
Well, when somebody is, you know, so huge like that, and there's nowhere in the world that they can go to seek any privacy. I mean, you could just imagine what that does to somebody's psyche, you know. So he used to take the plane home every night, and he used to come back every day. He had his own jet. So I'm in rehearsal in New York about a year and a half, almost 2 years later, and it's my opening day at the Copacabana. You could just imagine, I'm 18 years old, and I'm performing in probably the number one venue in the country as a headliner.
Right, yes.
Opening for anybody. So you can imagine the pressure. The press was coming. Television cameras were all over the place. I mean, you just can't imagine what it was like to open at the Copacabana.
It's like when I have to do a speech on Yom Kippur services. Terrifying.
Well, some people find it so. You know that people have that phobia, you know. And so there I was, you know, on a day like that, and somebody handed me some of my mail, and on top of my mail was this big, big yellow business envelope, and on the return address it said Palm Springs, California. And I opened it up, and there was a little note, and it said happy birthday, and it was a picture of me and Mr. Sinatra and the marquee with his name on it and mine.
I hope you still have that photograph.
You know I do. It's on my piano.
Oh, boy.
And it's been there since I was 18 years old.
Wow. So who are some of the other people, Julie Budd, that you worked with, that you learned from, that you loved, who were really wonderful to you?
Well, there were two people that... there were several people that were wonderful, but there were two people that were absolutely outrageously terrific to me. One was Carol Burnett.
Oh, wow. Okay.
One of the nicest people in the industry. She is just such a fine crafts person, and the last thing she would consider herself to be is a huge celebrity, you know, but she's just, which of course she is.
Of course, yeah.
The celebrity, she's entered legendary status, but she is a kind, smart, smart, good person. I did her TV show, which was so fantastic. I also subbed for her at Caesar's Palace.
Whoa.
Yeah, she had to leave an engagement and go back to Los Angeles, and I subbed for her. And she was just an elegant, elegant, wonderful person. And then another person who I became lifelong friends with and worked with at Caesar's Palace as well was Liberace.
Liberace! Oh, come on, you've got to tell me some Liberace stories. Oh, please, 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 please.
Well, one night, Lee and I were on stage, and we were doing a number from the Broadway show. I'm sure you remember it, and so I'm sure your listeners remember it. It was called No, No, Nanette, remember?
Oh, my gosh, okay, yes.
Great tap dancing show, and I had to learn how to tap dance. I mean, you can imagine the things that I had to learn on my feet. I had never had any formal training, so there I was learning how to tap dance with Liberace at Caesar's Palace. You can imagine how hard I worked. And there we were on stage, and we had to do a little step. It was called Shuffle Off to Buffalo, and that's when you head toward the wings and you tap off the stage. So I'm shuffling, and we're tapping off the stage. Finally, we get to the wings. Lee leans over to me, and he says, "You want to go to Paris?"
What? That's a long shuffle.
We're shuffling. We're in the wings now. I said, "Yeah, but we got to finish the number, Lee." So I ran out on stage. Lee follows me. We finish the number. It's the end of the show. We shuffle off again. He grabs my hand, says, "Grab whatever you need. Do you have a passport?" And I said, "Yeah, I got a passport." So I grabbed my passport. We got on a flight. We went to Paris. We had the greatest time. We went for about 4 or 5 days. It was incredible.
And you call it's incredible. You call him Lee.
I always called Liberace Lee. Yeah. Lee was a dear, dear friend. And it was his nickname, actually. All of his friends called him Lee. He was never known off stage as Liberace. He was always known as Lee.
I had no idea about that. Huh.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. No. We had the best time. And he was just a marvelous friend. You know, and just, I learned so much from him, and he was a great confidant, and he took great care of me, and you couldn't ask for a finer friend, you really couldn't. And when we lost him, you know, it was a big loss for me, because, you know, it was like losing a member of a family, you know, like a cousin or an uncle, you know, he was really dear to me. But, you know, every now and then, in a business that everybody, you know, always wants to say is so superficial and this way and that way, I was fortunate, you know, to walk away with some really, really nice friends. I really was.
Actually, but since we bring up Lee, or Liberace, as you call him, I'm wondering, since you knew him closer than the people who just put him on the TV and would see him there or in concert and stuff, how open was he about his private life to you? Was he clear about, oh, I am who I am, and, you know, I'm...
He was who he was. He absolutely... And remember, it was at a time when it may have been difficult for people to authentically be themselves.
Well, sure.
And, but we were so close that we never even had to have the discussion. Do you know what I mean? I mean, we were like brother and sister. We were really close. So it was never like he had to sit down and have that chat with me. I knew who he was, he knew who I was, and we were okay, you know. And it's funny, even to this day, I'm still really, really close to his choreographer.
Oh.
Yeah, I
Speaking
know.
Speaking of...
Such a good time with him that, you know, I know that one day we'll meet again. We'll all meet again, and we'll shuffle off to a better place.
Hullaby, hullaby. Instead of harps, the angels will be playing these giant rhinestone-encrusted pianos. It'll be a little bit different.
You know, he lived to make people happy. It was very, very nice to see that in Lee, because a lot of people say, what would you do if you were that famous? And what would you do if you were that rich? And what would you do? And what would you do if, you know, the world was just giving you everything you want 24/7? And, you know, his greatest pleasure was he loved to give people happiness. If a fan would come up to him and say, oh, you know, I wanted to come to your show, but... You know, ticket prices are high, I'm sorry, but please know that I always buy your CDs. You know what he would do? He would give her free tickets, and they would come to the show. He just loved people to be happy. He lived to make people happy, and it was such a joy to see that somebody took, you know, that kind of privilege and just always gave it back to people. He was just a wonderful, sweet soul, and I really loved that about him.
Can I ask you a question? You had mentioned No No Nanette. Was that the Broadway production or somewhere else?
Well, he was doing numbers from the Broadway.
Oh, he was doing it from No No Nanette. That's why I got a little bit.
He was reenacting Broadway productions
gotcha.
In his show. Now, when I tell you he was reenacting them, let me tell you, they were just as grand as the Broadway productions. I mean, if you knew Liberace's show, or if any of your friends that are listening to, you know, that are your audience that are listening have seen him live, they know what I'm telling you is true. His productions on stage, Rabbi, I'm telling you, if you saw these shows, the money that was spent on these shows, the production values were astounding. His costumes, now I'm going back to the 70s now, for somebody to say that they spent $2.5 million in 1970 on costumes, you can imagine what the production budget was on the show. And that was in 1970, 1971, 1972. So you can imagine, you know, comparatively speaking.
Yes, of course. Wow.
It was the productions in the show. And he took me to the London Palladium with me. He took me to France with him. We traveled all over the country and did tours together. We played Las Vegas. And we remained great friends up until the day he died.
Now, I am guessing, you have mentioned two amazing people in your life that you were great friends with and great colleagues with. One was Lee Liberace. Am I guessing the other's initials are M.H.?
Marvin Hamlin.
Okay, yeah, please.
Oh, yeah. You know the heartbreak of losing Marvin. First of all, it's very recent. It's only been 3 years.
Right.
And secondly, it was so untimely. You know, Marvin was still, he had so much to give, and he was still so productive, and he was only in his 60s, and, you know, for that matter, Lee was in his 60s as well. But, you know, he seemed so much older than me at the time, because Lee was my dad's age, you know what I mean? There was a great distance in age between me and Lee.
Whereas Marvin
was only about 15 years older than me. It wasn't like he was 40 years older than me or 30. You know, he felt closer to my generation. And it was more recent, as I said, you know, it's only 3 years ago. But I had known Marvin since I was in my early 20s. And I knew his mom and his sister, God bless them. And, you know, I knew his nephew. I mean, I knew his family. You know, right. I felt very connected to Marvin. And there were so many things in my life that connected me to Marvin. We both had a Disney contract, and we wound up working on a film together. And then we wound up doing soundtracks together. And I wound up doing their Playing Our Song, which was a play that he wrote. And then we wound up going on tour together for 7 years, up until 3 years ago, when it was during, you know, the time of his passing. I had been working with Marvin doing symphony concerts for 7 years. And it was so funny because he called me. I was on my vacation. And he called me and he said, "Hey, Jules, I want you to do some symphony concerts with me." And we were talking about the programming. And we were only going to do like the Kennedy Center. Not that I mean only the Kennedy Center.
Exactly.
I mean is just a few shows. We were going to do the Kennedy Center. We were going to do the Dallas Symphony. And we were going to do one or two others. And it wound up that we wound up doing 7 years. Can you imagine? From that phone call, 7 years on the road together.
Do you have any funny, amusing stories about your years on the road with Marvin Hamlisch?
Well, Marvin was a real baseball fan of the Yankees. He was really, I mean, Meshuggah with the baseball.
Okay.
To the point, if I tell you how Meshuggah he was with the baseball, I was on stage and I had a cue, and the cue is at the end of my piece, I turn to stage right, I take a bow, Marvin comes out, he meets me on stage, and then we wind up doing a number together, you know. So I finish, I take my final bow, I lean to the wing to reach out for Marvin, and I hear it like scores, like he's talking to somebody about the scores. He's missing a cue. This is the maestro. Why is he missing the cue? He's missing the cue because somebody hit a home run. Like, he was going so crazy from this. I walked partially to the wings, and I said, "My darling, grab my hand." And he went, "Oh, oh." And he grabs my hand, and then he grabs the mic, and he says, "You want to know what the score is?" To the audience, in the middle, missing it in the whole thing. "You want to know what the score is?" and he tells the audience the score. I know so nothing about baseball. You couldn't fill my pinky with what I know from baseball, right?
Right.
Wait. The audience goes totally crazy. The whole show becomes about Marvin getting the scores until the show is over. The audience gives us a standing ovation, not because we're so wonderful, because the team they were rooting for got, like, another home run. I mean, don't even ask what he used to do with baseball. He was so crazy with the baseball. But we had so much fun working together. And he was like a neighborhood kid who did well. He was a very smart guy.
His
parents, you know, suffered in the Holocaust, you know. And they were from Vienna. And they were very, very sophisticated, elegant people that were good musicians. His father was a wonderful musician who, unfortunately, his career was cut short by the war, you know.
Right.
They were lucky to get out of Europe alive. And they came here, and they had Marvin, and they had Terry, his sister. And Marvin was the youngest child to ever enter Juilliard. He entered Juilliard, he was 6-7 years old.
Oh, good Lord.
I know. There's never been another person like that in Juilliard. Marvin was a genius. And not only was it a loss to lose him as a friend, but it was a loss to the world to lose Marvin Hamlisch.
Well, of course. I mean, he, if nothing else, a chorus line, but of course there were a bunch of other things. He did scoring for films.
Of course. And movies and please, you could go on and on and on. But Marvin is a spirit. I remember the day Marvin died, and I remember the world felt so different to me, you know? Like it just, I don't know. There are certain people, when you lose them, the world is just not that sparkly anymore, you know?
Are your parents still with you?
No.
Oh, sorry.
No, I tell you, it was last week was my father's yahrzeit.
From how many years? Or was it 1 year?
No, it was 8 years.
8 years, okay.
Do you know what? It feels like yesterday. I'm telling you, it's like a blink. And my mother, Oliver Shalom, my mother was 3 years ago. It's going on 3.5 years ago. And I'll tell you something. It's like you don't even feel the time. It's a very odd thing. I'm still very, very, very connected to my parents, and I'll never not be. I don't want to not be. Isn't it funny?
Well, no, I would hope not. Yeah.
I'll get over it. You know what? I don't want to get over it. You know, because I'm close to them, and they'll always be with me.
And your parents probably weren't thrilled that you wanted to go into the showbiz, but they saw your determination and they didn't stop you.
Well, my father. You see, my mother, it's funny, my mother isn't funny parents. My parents, in some ways, could be very, very different than one another. But I think the thing that kept them close and connected was the important things they agreed on. Do you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And even though their personalities could be very different, when it came to the important issues, they agreed. You know, they shared the same point of view. My mother, being more liberal than my father, felt I should do this. My mother felt I was through and through a musician. And my mother was an elegant musician. She just didn't have, as we say in French, the cœur for this business.
Mm.
Because you gotta have a good belly for this business. It's a tough business. And my mother was a very gentle, sensitive soul. This was not the business for my mother, although she sang on radio as a child.
Oh.
Could not continue her musical career. It was too difficult a business for her emotionally. But my mother, artistically, had a splendid instrument. I've never heard an instrument like my mother's. My father, on the other hand, was a businessman and did not want me to be in show business because he thought everybody in show business was a bum. And what could his daughter get in show business but to marry another bum? You know, that kind of thing. Well, you know, my parents worried about me. They worried about me more than anything in the world. I swear to God, everything that they ever did was for us kids. And, my God, we loved them dearly, you know. So when I wanted to be in show business, my mother thought, you know what, you got to let her be who she is. My father, on the other hand, was petrified that I would get on drugs. He was petrified that I would meet up with the wrong fellow. He was, you know, all the things that a father would worry about, you know, with a daughter who's a free spirit and wants to be in show business. It's like your kid running off and joining the circus, you know. I mean, who wants that for their kids? But I think he recognized that You know, I really had my eye on the ball. I wasn't fooling around. I wasn't looking to be into show business to party. I was in show business because, you know, the music was, you know, in my bone marrow. And he knew that this was something eventually I was going to do. So he'd rather my do it under his watchful eye than to go off one day, you know, and do it on my own the wrong way. And when my father saw that I was getting these opportunities to work with Carol Burnett and work with Jim Nabors and work with Frank Sinatra and work with Liberace, he saw the caliber of my work. He saw how serious I was. And he told me two things that was very important. He said two things. He said, the day that you become a brat and the day that you don't take this seriously is the day Mommy and I are going to take you out of it. And then he also said, the second thing he said was, the day you don't want to do this anymore, you have a home to come to. You have a home. Don't you worry about anything. You always have a home to come back to. So, you see, I got a pretty good balance. I was very lucky. You know, they were strict, don't fool around, but you have a home. So, you know, I was more serious as a kid than I am now. I have more fun with the business now than I did when I was a kid.
Oh, that's good. That's good, because, you know, you kind of missed having a childhood if you were being professional from age 12, and then by 16 working with Sinatra and 18 headlining the Copa. I mean, there were certain things you probably missed.
Childhood I wanted. You know, you miss this, you miss that, but it was really what I wanted. So maybe I didn't miss anything at all. But I became a little bit more authentically myself in terms of accepting how things are in the business and being able to function under the pressure. I became much more easygoing with it as I got older than when I was as a kid, because as a kid I didn't have any experience to back it up.
But now,
flying by the seat of my pants, you know what I mean?
Well, as we get older, is it easier or harder to keep up with an itinerary where you have to be on a plane probably every week to, or twice a week, to go flying somewhere to do a concert, then do another concert, and then this, or you're not slowing down from any of that?
I really haven't. You know, I mean, I'm fairly young when you think about, you know, the cycle of people's lives. I'm still a fairly young person because I started so young. People always think you're so much older. But I'm still a fairly young person. I'm in very good physical shape.
Not good.
Yeah, and I'm very serious about that, too. And I still have a lot of ambition, and my ambitions, of course, you know, they change. I'm writing now. I'm teaching. I produce my own shows. I go out and I perform them in theaters and performing arts centers. I do more things now than I did when I was younger. When I was younger, I was primarily, you know, just a vocalist, where now I produce my own CDs. I produce shows. I go out on the road. I do a whole, because, you know, you have a wealth of experience so that it allows you to do those things. But when I was young, I was just primarily a musician. But I was very, very lucky. I'll tell you where I was super lucky.
Where?
That when I was younger, I fell into the right hands because I had really good people. Like my conductor is the same conductor from when I was 12 years old. And my vocal teacher was one of the finest teachers probably in the country. And I've heard that a lot of kids get in the wrong hands when they're younger and their instruments become really torn up, you know. But that I was very, very fortunate that I had gotten into the right hands, because when I started out in the business, I had no formal training. And I didn't start training until I was in the business several years. So I was very lucky I got in the right hands, because it saved my throat. It really saved my instrument.
But well, when you teach,
40 years later, you could still, you know, perform and be in good shape.
And as you said, you are a vocal coach and a teacher. When you mentioned something about the there are three rules of voice for an actor and a singer. Yes,
I said there are three rules?
And it's somewhere on your website. There are three words, three key words that you talk about. Something about, like, protect, enhance.
Oh, yes. Now I know what you're saying.
Okay.
It was in the it was in the paragraph where I described the vocal technique, the art of vocal technique. You need to preserve and protect your instrument. That's what you're talking about.
Right.
You need to preserve and protect it. And by doing that, it's not enough that you were born with a natural great instrument, because the rigors of the industry can take you down, because you could wind up not having any technique. And you go out on this tour, like let's say you have this huge hit record or something really great happens in your career, or you're on TV a lot, which is what happened to me when I was a kid. And then I found myself on the road for many, 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 many years. So what happens is if you don't have any vocal technique, or any technique even as an actor, or whatever it may be, as a dancer, you can really become injured. And then you could find yourself out of the tour more than you're in the tour, because what happens is you're always down because you know, you've been hurt, you've been injured. And a lot of dancers find that. A lot of dancers that weren't well-trained or classically trained, they get Broadway shows, they do great, but then they get injured. Because dancing is very athletic.
Of course, yeah.
You know, if you don't know how to make those jumps, if people don't know how to catch you when you do leaps, dancing could be dangerous if you're doing, you know, intricate work up there.
Even if you are careful, accidents happen with dance. At least for voice you can protect a little bit more. Nobody's going to, accidentally hit you
voice,
in the throat.
Oh, no. But, voice can be very treacherous.
Ooh.
Voice can be so treacherous because if you don't eat right, if you don't sleep right, if you don't train well, if you have a lot of tension, if you're flying in a plane and the air is dry, you get off the plane, you've got to run to do a 3-hour rehearsal, and then you do a 2-hour show. Your body, the rigor is, if you don't have technique to back up what you're doing, you could lose your voice. And people have.
Of course. Well, what is a technique? I mean, if you don't really have a choice. If you're flying on an airplane, you have to run to the rehearsal, then you have to be on stage. How do you avoid that? I mean, how do you keep your throat okay if you have to do that?
As you get more experience, you let your agent know that you need to arrive at the venue the day before.
Oh, okay.
You have to start learning what works for you. Now, often, it's just a scheduling thing. You can't help it. You know, you're coming back to New York to do a huge TV show. You can't say no. Well, then you have to pace yourself. And then you have to live with your technique very, very carefully. So that you can do things that you know that you have in your arsenal to protect yourself. But if you don't know those things and you just go out, you're going to get hurt. You need to have technique, whether you're an actor or a dancer. Or a singer.
Or a rabbi.
I was going to say, as a rabbi.
Oh, yes.
Don't you need to know when you go into a family's home and they're sitting shiver and they're mourning a terrible loss, God forbid, a child or something really terrible happens to that family. You need to have been trained in psychology so that you know that you won't hurt people by saying the wrong thing.
Oh, my God. I used to go in there. They were mourning. I would slap the dagger. I said, get over it. The hell is wrong with you?
But, right, technique is everything, right? I mean, you need to be trained in whatever you do.
No.
And that's going to be the thing that gives you legs, because that's going to be the thing that keeps you in the ball game. And a lot of people say to me, I have a talented son, or I have a talented daughter. What do I do? And the first thing I tell them is, train this child.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you're going to know right away if this is a kid that should be in the business. Because the training is very rigorous if it's done right. So if this kid says, I don't want to do it, I don't want to go, then you know that's not a kid that belongs in this business. Don't push this child.
Right.
You're gonna know right away. You know what I mean?
Well, certainly someone who belongs in the business and has stayed in the business for 4 or more decades now is the wonderful and delightful Julie Budd. I want to remind people, first of all, before we continue, that she has a new CD out. It's her version of all songs that Frank Sinatra made famous. I keep referring to it as Mr. Sinatra, but it's, what's the full title?
Well, it's called Julie Budd, Remembering Mr. Sinatra.
Remembering Mr. Sinatra.
And you know what? We just got released yesterday, so they could go on Amazon, iTunes, CD Baby, Barnes & Noble, every one of the websites online will sell it. And if they don't want to download it, you know, because a lot of this computer stuff makes people totally nuts, they can get the CD. All they have to do, they can even just call. They don't even have to buy it online. There's 800 numbers for all of these companies. They could pick up the phone, give them a credit card, it'll be delivered to their home the next day.
Was that the reason you made the choice in this day and age to still release a hard copy actual compact disc in a case with a disc?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Because you would be surprised. Even in these modern times, there are people that like a regular CD. Mm-hmm. And I wanted anybody, I didn't want anyone to be excluded. I wanted anyone who loves this music to be able to enjoy it.
Actually, all I have is an 8-track. I don't know. Do you have that on 8-track?
Oh, gosh. Remember the 8-tracks.
I do. You have to rewind and go back to the first thing. And
oh, God. Those and answering services. Remember the answering services?
Oh, my God. Yes. Yes, the actors are going to have to get to a phone booth and, oh, my God.
Oh, gosh. We lived through all of this technology. What is going to be the second act? What are they going to do? Flying cars. I heard they have flying cars now.
No. Well, what is a drone? If you make a bigger drone, that could be a flying car, couldn't it?
I mean, I'm dangerous on the ground. Do you really want to put me in the air?
Oh, God. That's right. I'm dangerous walking, let me tell you. Now, by the way, we were talking, you mentioned movies. You've done a couple of movies here and there. It hasn't been a big part of your resume. But I just noticed this. I joked early in the conversation about Bill Cosby. You did a movie with him. I forgot about this.
Listen, not only did I do a movie with Bill Cosby, but 2 years before I worked with Mr. Sinatra, believe it or not, I was 14 years old.
Oh, no.
And I worked with Bill Cosby at the International Hotel. It's in Las Vegas.
Do you have any, and they don't have to be what we're thinking of, do you have any stories? Did you get a weird feeling about him, or was he totally fine in the times that you, or in the movie when he did The Devil and Max Devlin?
When I worked with him in Vegas, it was a little bit of a turbulent time, but nothing.
Okay.
Nothing related to any of the controversy. Absolutely nothing at all related to that. But when I worked with him in the film, it was about 9 years later, and I was, I don't know, 24 years old, 23 years old. Maybe I was a little older. God, I can't remember. I was in my mid to early 20s. I worked with him. I did a film with him. He was fine.
Okay.
He was...
You had a setup there. I was, like, dreading the finale of that sentence.
Yeah. I never had an experience like that with Bill Cosby. Okay.
Was it turbulent? Was the
I
previous...
I had other mishigas with him. But
yeah, what was turbulent with him? Was he just... Was it the 60s? Or no, it wouldn't have been the 60s. But then what was... Was he just difficult as a star would be? How was he turbulent?
Yeah, he was. When I worked with him in Vegas, he was. But I think, you know what happened to Bill Cosby at that time when I first met him? I think he was getting his sea legs. He was not really used to being... he was really becoming an enormous star. It was right after I Spy,
uh-huh,
that time, a couple of years after that. And he was the first African-American leading man on television to really become, you know, as big as he became. And he had been a huge staple with the youth in the country and college concerts and all of these places. And this was his first real big, I call it grown-up engagement, if you will, because it was mainstream. It was putting him out into the mainstream public in a whole other way than he was used to being out there.
Okay.
And I don't think he handled it well.
Hmm.
I bet you if you chatted with him about that, he would admit that I was correct, that he didn't handle it well. But years later, when I met him about 8 or 9 years later again, and we wound up co-starring in a film together, he appeared to be a person that was a little bit more grown up about it all.
Oh, okay. Well, and even when he was turbulent, he didn't take it out on you, so you just saw him behaving that way, or was he not so great to you?
No, he did take it out on me. As a matter of fact, he wound up firing me.
Oh, my God. Oh, bested. Nasty.
No. Listen, you want to know something? I don't know. Maybe I'm just stupid, but I don't hold grudges. I don't hold it against him. It was his journey. It was his thing. It was his time. He had to grow up. He had to get with the program. I didn't do anything wrong, Rabbi. Oh, yeah. He didn't fire me because I did anything wrong or I misbehaved.
Maybe, you know, if you misbehaved, it would have put you on salary.
No. Listen, I was a good kid. My parents were there. As I said, Herbie was there. I was 14 years old.
Oh, well, yeah.
Thanks. I was doing my homework in between shows. I was a very good kid.
Now, can I ask you
it
also...
It wasn't about me. It was he had yeah. Michigas. He had a lot of Michigas.
Sure.
And look, he had to come to terms with his Michigas, and he did. I met him again 8-9 years later. And then, to hear all this stuff about him, it was really disturbing for me to hear it. And I felt bad for the victims, the alleged victims, and I felt very bad for him. I just...
Really? Oh, okay. No, well, wait, no, well...
I'll tell you why.
No.
Let me tell you why. Because out of all of the things that he did in his life, and he did some very good things for a lot of African-American
sure.
kids that never otherwise would have gone to college and gone on to higher education. He gave a lot to museums. He gave a lot to Temple University. He really tried to further education. And you know the sad thing about this whole thing?
What?
Going on, is when his name is mentioned now in the future, no one is going to think about all the good things he did. They're only going to remember this terrible thing that he's being accused of. And whether he is guilty of it or not is not my position, you know. If he's
well.
Guilty, the law will take care of him. I believe that. But the sadness is if he did do this to himself, okay, to himself, it's sad because the only thing after all these years of trying to be something, this is the only thing that people are going to remember about him. To me, this is the saddest thing of all.
Well, I mean, you look at someone like Phil Spector, who made amazing
right.
music for all those years,
right.
but he was a Looney Tune, and very likely he is a murderer. It's only right that we remember Phil Spector as a murderer.
Correct. And the sad thing is they do it to themselves. Nobody did this to Bill, and nobody
oh, no.
did it to Phil. They did it to themselves.
Well, the problem is they did it to... And Bill Cosby, 50 other women. That's a big problem there.
If he is guilty of these terrible crimes that people are saying are so, it is beyond horrible.
Okay.
And he did it to himself. And it, as a result, of course, as you say, he damaged these other people. This is a huge crime. Listen, if he did it to one person, it's a huge...
Oh, absolutely. I totally agree. By the way, on a happier subject, but also sort of a 6 degrees subject that you've probably been asked about since you were 16 years old. In that film that I keep bringing up, The Devil and Max Devlin, the lead actor there was a fellow named Elliot Gould, right?
Sweetest man on the planet. Elliot Gould, if you looked in Webster's Dictionary... Under sweet, his picture is right.
Oh, now...
The nicest man in this business.
A man who was married to someone that people somehow associate with you. If you look on the interwebs, there are places that say you're her half-sister. You're not even remotely related.
They always confuse because they know Barbara has a sister. And so they get confused. You know, her sister's name is Rosalind Kind.
Yes, I interviewed her. She was on this radio program.
Yeah, she's a lovely gal.
Oh, yeah.
Good singer. But, you know, I over the years, I've worked a lot, and thank God I've made a place in for myself in this industry. I've been extraordinarily lucky, and so I've been out there, and they know she has a sister, so they've always sort of confused me as being the sister. But no, I am not her sister, but I certainly enjoyed my time with Elliot Gould, and we've remained friends over the years. He's a lovely man.
Oh. And can I ask also, have you, or you were in a film, I don't know if you have any scenes in there with him, but a few years ago, you were in a movie with Joaquin Phoenix.
Yeah, I did have scenes with Joaquin, of course. And lovely person.
Good.
You know, he's a little bit offbeat. You know, a lot of people don't know how to take it with Joaquin. Because he's very, very much his own sort of personality, you know? But, you know, I come from a sort of place where, you know, when you just accept who people are, you know, you can just take it from there, you know what I mean? And he's just, he's a wonderful actor. He's very sensitive. I don't know. Do you know that Joaquin Phoenix told me that his mother is Jewish?
Huh? Yay!
Did you know that?
No. How would I know that he told you that his mother's Jewish?
Yeah, well, I figured Jewish geography. You'd find out.
This is good. What does he identify as? Is he...
Jewish. Pretty sure he does.
Yay! I'm so happy.
I think he does. I think he identifies himself as being Jewish.
This is nice. This is good. Now, here's another question
I
have.
I enjoyed my time with him. You know, he was a very, very interesting and smart person to work with. And that was just... we had a great director on that film by the name of James Gray. What a smart director. Gee, I hope I get to work with him again because, you know, when you get to work with people who are really special like that, you really do miss it, you know?
The name of the film that people are looking for it on Netflix was Two Lovers. It's from 2008.
Two Lovers. I had a lead, actually, when I worked for Disney and when I worked with Elliot. And Bill, I had the lead role, and I had all the music in it. But when I worked in Two Lovers, I had a very small part. But it was just nice to be part of the ensemble. I enjoyed it.
Well, can I ask how you divide your time these days, Julie Budden? Most of it is, of course, music and concerts. But how much movies, how much TV, how much other things are you doing?
Well, a lot of my time right now, in this past year and a half, I should really say, has been spent recording. I've really been focusing. Right before I did my Sinatra CD, about a year before that, I had another CD called They Wrote the Songs. And it was all about, you know how everybody talks about the American Songbook and it's Gershwin and Cole Porter and Hammerstein, and that's all terrific. I mean, how do you beat that?
Right.
But I really wanted to pay tribute to the new writers that will be the future American Songbook. Because we have to look toward the future. You can't just live in the past. So I recorded things that Anthony Newley and Leslie Brickus wrote. I recorded stuff that Paul Anka wrote. Charles Smalls, he wrote The Wiz, The Beatles, Ann Hampton Calloway. You know,
Because believe it or not, The Beatles and Leslie Brickus, and that's already 50 years old. It's not exactly such new American songbook. But
when you think about the American songbook, and what you're saying is correct, but when you think about the American songbook, people always go back to the pre-war era.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They always go back to the 30s or the 40s, you know, even the 50s. I mean, they go back to that era of during the war or pre-war, Gershwin, Jerome Kern, Oscar Hammerstein, you know, Sigmund Romberg. They go back to, you know, if you come to New York and you go around the country and you go to the cabarets where people are doing American Songbook series, they always go back to 30s, 40s, and 50s. And I thought nothing on the CD should be written before 1960. And that's how I sort of looked at as the cutoff point where contemporary American songbook would begin, would be around the time when the Beatles came, because that was really the pivotal time in American music, world music, because they came from England, but when we really saw a change in the American songbook.
Of course.
And I really thought that really started in the 60s.
Well, what's interesting is that you've managed to have a career in a songbook style, even amidst the sea change that the Beatles and the British Invasion created. Because, you know, everybody else was picking up a guitar, but you're still doing from Rodgers and Hart through Paul Anka through, I guess, Barry Manilow, through people like that.
And even Eric Clapton, I added him to the concert show because I felt that writers like Elton John and Eric Clapton were writing quality pieces that I felt that decades from now people are going to still want to perform.
Interesting. What Elton John song do you do?
Sorry seems to be the hardest word.
And what about,
I also recorded it on my new classic CD because I felt that it needed its moment in that songbook. And then for Eric Clapton, it was Tears in Heaven.
Oh, God. Well, yeah. We know why he wrote that one.
Yeah, but, you know, it's an important piece of music, and I felt that, yes, we know why he wrote it, and it came out of a lot of pain, but his ability to cross over from, you know, being the sort of guitar rock player to a very legitimate piece that could be done on stage with a symphony, you know, which is where I perform it. I thought it was an astounding stretch on his behalf.
Cool. Well, we have been... I'm trying to make an interesting segue here we've been stretching our minds and our souls, how's that, with Julie Budd, the delightful, the talented Julie Budd. Her new CD, Julie Budd, Remembering Mr. Sinatra, is available from all the usual places. And by the way, I haven't even mentioned that you can go see her on Thursday, September 10th at 7 o'clock at the Metropolitan Room, where you are a guest artist. I totally forgot about this. So you, live and in person, you're doing once a month, really, at the Metropolitan Room on various dates.
Yes, and also, I'll be there in October on the 21st. I'll be there December 10th. But in September as well,
yeah.
On the 28th of September, right after I finish the Metropolitan Room on the 10th, on the 28th, I'm going to be at Barnes & Noble on East 86 in Lexington. I'm bringing my entire band into the store.
I'm
going to do selections from the CD, Mr. Sinatra, and then Tom Santopietro, who wrote the book Sinatra in Hollywood, is going to interview me.
Nice! And that's at the Barnes & Noble on 86th on what night, what day?
That's going to be September 28th at 7 p.m.
September 28th at 7 p.m. Oh, so you're going to be
over. I love the idea of Tom giving me the interview, you know, being the host for the interview, because he wrote the book Sinatra in Hollywood.
Perfect. It works. By the way, can I ask you, Julie Budd, have you heard the Dylan album?
Yes.
And?
You know what? I liked it.
I like some of it, too. Honest to
gosh. I liked it because, you know, I like the idea that Bob Dylan was smart enough to realize that within the time that came before him, during him, and after him, that this was work that was going to survive, and that he wanted to be a part of that legacy. And I thought, okay, Bob, that's a great move. I like that you're doing that. Because out of that, in the future, people that are interested in this music will also be interested in what Bob Dylan left behind as well. He becomes a part of it all.
Oh, agreed, yes.
I like that he chose that.
Cool. Oh, good. I'm so glad that you were open, because everybody kind of makes fun of it, and his voice is shot, obviously, even worse than mine.
Well, Bob Dylan was never known to be Pavarotti, and he never tried to get up there and be Jack Jones or Pavarotti or Frank Sinatra. That was never what he was trying to do. You know, he was a storyteller. He was a poet that did his poetry to music. And he had an identifiable sound, and he had his message. You know, pretty much the way Pete Seeger, had his, you know?
Exactly. Oh, boy, I'm so glad to hear you say this. And, and just to get on the personal side for a moment, I am curious about this. In an interview a few years ago, you mentioned that you had a quote here, "I have a beautiful man in my life." Is that man still in your life? Is it?
Yes, of course.
Oh.
His name is Dr. John Wagner.
Oh, a doctor. Oh, there you go.
Vodan.
A Jewish doctor.
Vodan.
Are you married?
Not yet. No, we're engaged, and he's a very sweet man. His family, you know, my grandpa was an Jewish Englishman, that came to the United States, and that's on Mama's side, and on Papa's side, they were from Austria and Hungary. On my mother's side, they were German and English. Everybody, of course, via Russia, you know, two generations before. But John's family, of course, they hailed from Russia first, but then they went to England. And a lot of his family is English.
Oh, my gosh. But how long have you been engaged to this man?
Oh, a long time. Very, very long time. But we both promised each other that if we ever get married, we're going to marry each other.
Oh. Well,
He's darling. And, you know, you talk about people that do, you know, mitzvahs for other people. You know, the way I was, you know, talking about Lee and how he loved to give things to people. John is that way. You know, it really made me learn that my mother was so smart. She knew that people had a calling. My mother knew my calling was music, and John's calling is medicine. You know, like we all have our little mitzvahs. You know, we all have our little thing to do. And I think that it's great when you can find out in your life whatever your little mitzvah is supposed to be, you know?
That is sweet. That is, I still don't know what the hell mine would be. Absolutely.
Come on,
not.
You're a great communicator. You make people laugh. You make people smile. And let me tell you something. In this world, it is the most important thing that you could do for people is make them feel.
That's right. If they're hungry, if they're starving, if they have no food, make them laugh. Much more important.
Absolutely.
I totally agree with that. I'm kidding, of course.
No, but you want to know something on a really serious and poignant note about that. I was doing a show one time for Holocaust survivors. And I know, and year after year, you know, you go back to the annual meetings, and it said, you know, there's less and less of them because, you know, they're getting to
of
be
course.
30
yeah.
years old, some of these people. But I remember one lady saying to me, and I swear, Rabbi, I swear when she said it to me, I couldn't believe it was true, but she swore to me it was true. She said when they were in Auschwitz, and my heart even hurts when I tell you the story. She said, the conditions. She said, forget about thinking we would ever have children or be married. She says, we just wanted to live to the next day, have something to eat. She says, but at night, when we were alone, she said, some of the things that kept us alive, she says, we would try to make each other laugh. Huh. She said it was our way of staying alive. And when I heard that, I couldn't believe she told me the truth, that, you know, that in their misery and seeing the worst of humankind, that she would think, how can we laugh? How could we laugh? Because she realized that was one of the instruments to sort of go on. So when somebody says to me, oh, you know, I'm just a comedian, or I'm just a singer, or, you know, it's an important thing because, you know, for the 1 hour that people come and see you, you know, like, you made them forget their problems.
Well, Julie Budd, you have made me forget all my many, many, many problems for the past
hope
hour.
You don't have any.
Oh, well, we won't get into that. But I'm so glad we've gotten into so many things with this wonderful, delightful lady. By the way, you've got to go to her website, juliebudd.com, and that's two D's on the end of that, juliebudd.com, to find out more about all her CDs, not just Remembering Mr. Sinatra, the new one, plus all her club dates in the Metropolitan Room on September 10th, and then on October 21st, and again in November.
And I'm taking the show to Las Vegas in the spring.
Mazel.
We're going to go to the Smith Center, because I met Mr. Sinatra there, and I'm also going to be at the Berry Center in New Jersey. And I'm taking the show there on Mr. Sinatra's birthday, December 12th.
Well, wouldn't that be his centenary? Isn't that when would it turn 100?
Yes, it's his centennial birthday. He's 100 years old on December 12th. And on that night, we're going to have a little birthday cake for him. And we're going to sing all these wonderful songs at the Berry Center in Ramapo, New Jersey. And we're going to wish him a happy birthday.
Oh, mazel. Man, that sounds lovely. To all these, you gotta go to her website to take part to enjoying all these great things you're doing. Last question for you, Ms. Budd, my delightful friend, if I may call you a friend now.
Thank you.
The one person, another blue-eyed person that I haven't even had time to mention yet, but you appeared more than, I think, than 100 times on the Merv Griffin Show. Do you have any Merv Griffin stories?
Well, you know, I loved Merv dearly, and Merv, the first time he ever met me, you see, I should tell you a little bit, Herb Bernstein, my conductor, has sold over 40 million records. He recorded Laura Nero.
Oh, my gosh.
And the recordings that he did with Laura are in the Grammy Hall of Fame. He recorded The Four Seasons, The Happenings, Dusty Springfield, so many people. And he was recording Merv Griffin. After Herb met me when I was 12 years old, he took me down to the studio to meet Merv Griffin. I had never done anything in this business. I was just barely 12 years old. And Merv played on the break. He said, Merv, I want you to hear this little girl sing. And Merv said, oh, please, Herbie, please. Don't make me listen to some kid that sings at weddings and bar mitzvahs, you know? And Herbie said to Merv, he said, Merv, please, even if it's four bars, listen to the kid. So Merv started playing I'm Always Chasing Rainbows. To Merv's surprise, I knew that song and I started singing it. And 3 days later, I was on television and my life began.
Wow. So I'm sure that may have been one of your favorite Merv times on TV. Was there another time that you remember of all those dozens and dozens of appearances that was your favorite funny?
There were so many appearances. But I'll tell you who I absolutely loved was his sidekick, Arthur Treacher.
I remember who Arthur Treacher was, but I don't remember him being the sidekick. Huh.
He was Merv's sidekick. Remember how Johnny had Ed McMahon?
Yes, of course.
Well, and you remember how Joey Bishop had Regis Philbin.
Right. So Arthur Treacher was
was Merv Griffin's sidekick.
Oh, my God. Something fishy about that.
And I used to do routines with Arthur Treacher. Oh, God, it was amazing. Listen, Arthur Treacher went way back to the days of Shirley Temple. He was a great song and dance man in his day. He used to, if you rent all of those old Shirley Temple tap, you know, numbers and Dan Daly, and Arthur Treacher was one of those people that did films with Shirley Temple. That was Merv Griffin's sidekick. And when I was a little girl, 12 years old, I used to do routines with Arthur Treacher.
Oh, my God. You know, I wish I had done routines with Arthur Treacher when I was a little girl.
No.
I don't even know what
one is enough. One is enough.
Well, you are a unique and priceless one, Julie Budd. Thank you a million, a zillion, a gazillion times for being on the program here with us and with me. I wish you a very happy and healthy Rosh Hashanah and the High Holy Days.
Yes, you too. Only health and happiness.
Oh, to you too. And thank you again, and shalom to you.
Shalom, Rabbi. Shalom.